The most powerful earthquake to hit Puerto Rico in a century has exposed major vulnerabilities in the island's infrastructure.
There's quite a bit of collapsed buildings and very few people still actually living in the center of the city. A lot of people have moved elsewhere or living in, you know, makeshift or temporary accommodations.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for January 13th, we'll check in on how Puerto Ricans are managing as aftershocks continue to damage the island. And tourism is central to the economy for many islands in the Caribbean, but island residents don't always benefit.
There's definitely a lot of troublesome relationships, a lot of exploitation that happens because of that. And a lot of it also is about race and class.
We begin in San Juan. Let's get started.
We had a magnitude 5.9, 10 miles south of Indios, Puerto Rico.
At least 300 people, including lots of children, are living in a tent city in the earthquake-damaged Guayanilla. There's very little left of where they once lived.
One of the people I interviewed was an 80-year-old woman named Lupita Martinez, who is outside a shelter in the southwest coastal town of Guanica. She was sitting in a white plastic chair next to her husband, who's 96 years old, in a makeshift bed next to her. She kept trying to get a hold of their caretaker. You know, she couldn't find her. You know, her husband is not doing well physically, and they were trying to figure out if they could get to a hospital. There's hundreds of people sleeping in shelters, streets, cars. They're terrified of another strong earthquake.
Hurricane comes in, it goes through. This is staying with us. Every time the ground shakes, there's a lot of concern and fear. And at some points, we kind of have to start over from ground zero again.
You do have convergence between the Caribbean plate and the North American plate. And the island is being squeezed in between the two of those plates at the same time, which results in pressure buildup. And ultimately, that pressure has to be released at some point.
On Saturday morning, a 5.9 magnitude earthquake shook Puerto Rico, leaving behind a path of destruction along the island's southern coast. That was reporting from the AP's Danica Cotto. The quake is just the latest seismic activity to rattle the island in recent weeks. Last Tuesday, a 6.4 magnitude earthquake struck the same area, killing one person and injuring nine others. It was the most powerful earthquake to hit Puerto Rico in more than a century, and it knocked out electricity across most of the island and destroyed hundreds of homes, as well as several schools and businesses. In the weeks leading up to these powerful earthquakes, more than 2,000 smaller quakes occurred around the island. After Tuesday's earthquake, Puerto Rican Governor Wanda Vasquez estimated $110 million in damages. But that figure doesn't account for the heavy emotional and mental toll these earthquakes are having on the lives of Puerto Ricans. At the same time, the island is also struggling to recover from the devastation of Hurricane Maria in 2017, as well as the political and economic turmoil that's rocked the island over the past few years. Here with me now from Puerto Rico is David Begno, lead national correspondent for CBS This Morning. David, great to have you back on the show.
You bet, Tanzina.
David, you've been reporting from the island for the past week. Puerto Rico, as we know, is not prepared generally for earthquakes. Are you seeing structural damage across the island, David? And if so, what kind?
Oh, certainly. Look, you have homes that are flattened. I mean, like I'm talking about, it looks as though it imploded and it's a pancake and the roof is sitting on the cement below. But there are other homes that are cracked. I want everybody listening to understand this and try and walk in the shoes of the people here. Since December 29th, they have felt the earth shake, usually a few times a day. Imagine going through that. It's like one lady said to me, a hurricane, I know when it's coming. An earthquake, I have no clue.
Well, but Wanda Vasquez, the governor, said that she had signed a request for, quote, major disaster declaration from the U.S. government. Where does that stand, David? And what are folks saying to you about how the Puerto Rican government, at least, is handling this so far?
Okay, so number one. Everyone here is waiting to see if the president signs the major disaster declaration. Mr. Trump signed an emergency disaster declaration, which allowed for FEMA to help with life-sustaining things, food, water, cots, nothing more, okay? Now, the major disaster declaration, if the president signs it, that would help with things like temporary housing, putting people in other shelters, maybe hotel rooms. But remember, this is not the States. You don't have tons of hotels all over the place. So if you start bringing people to San Juan and put them in hotels, there's a limited number of hotels. That's number one. Number two, people here have a profound distrust of the government. So we saw the mountain communities, the roads jam-packed yesterday. I'm talking bumper to bumper where the backup was like an hour. And most of the backup were local folks who were coming from other areas with supplies that they had picked up that they were delivering themselves. Now, the governor said yesterday, please, y'all are causing a traffic jam. Distribute it to your local officials and they'll give it out. And the people I've heard from have said, oh, no, no, no. I don't trust you. I'm not giving you anything. You let us down during Maria. I don't believe that you're going to be here now. Sorry, we're going ourselves to do it.
This is coming on the heels of an economic crisis that the island faced, then Hurricane Maria, then the ouster of Ricardo Rosselló, the governor, this past summer, and now this series of earthquakes. What are people telling you about whether or not they want to stay on the island? I mean, we've seen a migration out of Puerto Rico over the past few years. Should we expect more of that in the aftermath of these quakes?
Listen, there has been a migration to the States. But there's a lot of people, Tanzina, who still want to stay and will stay. And I'm not talking about parents and grandparents. I'm talking about young people. I'm talking about college students who are fighting for a better classroom that's not as damaged and consistently has electricity because they don't want to leave their island. And you have a lot of people in the States who want to come back to the island. I can't tell you I've heard anybody within last week talk about leaving. This is not the same as we saw after Maria. However, there has been some video of the airport being quite packed. And I've heard from people. I heard from a lady yesterday who messaged me and said, David, I'm trying to evacuate my father from Ponce. He's going to fly out in 5 days. United Airlines is not waiving the fee to help us get him out faster. Is there anything you can do? So I reached out to United. Listen, arguably reporters shouldn't be that involved. But at the end of the day, when you're dealing with people who don't have power, who don't have water, who are desperate to get out, you just do what feels human. Now, let me update those numbers. Regarding the power and electricity, we're hearing from officials on the island that both are at about 98%. That sounds great, right? Because there's 3.5 million people who live here. You should know that there's only about 1.3 million water customers. So more than half they're not a customer of the water utility system. And only half the population here is an electricity customer. Okay, so there's a whole lot of people without either, but they weren't. It has nothing to do with the earthquakes. And the people who do have power, Tanzina, it goes out daily. So you got it at 8, you lose it at 2. Is it to blame just on the earthquakes? No, they have a dilapidated power grid, and it was that way even before Maria. But the earthquakes have damaged it. So bottom line, the power just goes off and on. So to say that, oh, everybody has it sounds good until you realize that it's exceptionally unreliable.
David Begno, you've been covering this story for quite some time, and I know people on the island really appreciate that. David Begno, lead national correspondent for CBS This Morning. Thanks always for joining us.
I thank you.
We're going to focus in now on the mental health impacts of disasters like the earthquakes in Puerto Rico. Joining me to discuss is Rosaura Ornego Aguayo, an assistant professor and clinical psychologist at the Medical University of South Carolina. And her research focuses on the psychological aftermath of natural disasters like Hurricane Maria. Rosaura, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So you're working closely with mental health providers who are in Puerto Rico right now. What are you hearing about how people are responding to the latest disaster?
So what I'm hearing from boots on the ground is there's a lot of obvious basic needs that haven't been met. Children sleeping with shoes on, lots of panic attacks, especially at night, lots of just hopelessness and a sense of general fear. And unlike Maria, what they're observing and telling me is that there's no end point yet. And this is new. So lots of anxiety across children and parents.
I mean, we've heard from folks who say, you know, we can predict more or less when a hurricane is about to hit, but this is much more unpredictable. And it's also relatively new. Puerto Rico has not had earthquakes in about a century. So is that part of where this is coming from? Or is this compounded trauma from Hurricane Maria and the political instability on the island, and now this series of earthquakes?
So unlike hurricanes, where it's accompanied by a season, right, from the fall, there's no predictability to an earthquake. Puerto Ricans are used to natural disasters that have a beginning, middle, and end, like hurricanes, as terrible as it can be. These aftershocks, and sometimes of increase or equal magnitude, are very terrifying. So add that compounded trauma of a devastating island-wide hurricane in 2017, political unrest, on and off power and water, all of this combined. So it's not just an earthquake, it's a compilation.
Getting ambulances to people who have been affected by the earthquake has been a challenge. And we saw a lot of these challenges with just the healthcare infrastructure after Hurricane Maria. What does the mental health infrastructure look like in Puerto Rico right now?
Maria kind of revealed how fragile the mental health infrastructure of Puerto Rico was. However, Maria brought a gift, which was an awakened interest in the importance of training mental health providers on the islands to deliver evidence-based trauma-focused care. So for the past 2 years, many agencies have been building local capacity on the island. However, there's still much, much help that is needed.
Mental health is one of those things that's much more difficult to discern, I think, because it's not the same as having, say, a broken leg, right? So how are people identifying those who are in need of trauma services right now?
Just as we have first aid responders, we have what's called psychological first aid. So these social workers, psychologists, volunteers that are trained are going on the ground and talking to families, assessing basic needs. And while they're doing that assessment, they observe for certain things such as desperation, fear, several days without sleep, or even stomach pains or nervousness or anxiety. And then they triage and refer those that need immediate crisis assistance to, you know, the BAS hotline or APS community health care clinics that have been open in every single town that has been affected. The interesting thing here is I think we're more equipped to handle those immediate crises. It's the aftermath that's a problem. So if we're continuing to see specifically in children these symptoms of irritability, lack of sleep, panic attacks, wetting the bed, anxiety of leaving their caregivers, not wanting to go to school, that's when these kids really need a referral to a specialist that is trained in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy.
And Arsalda, what about in adults? I guess what are the predictors of resiliency in adults right here when it comes to dealing with these types of disasters?
Resiliency in adults looks a lot like these are adults that immediately seek social support. Doesn't mean you're less stressed, but it means that you're being active. You're seeking the help that your children need. You're hydrating. You're trying to eat. You're having healthy conversations with your children and honest conversations about what happened as a family. And you try to maintain your routine as much as you can. All these are predictors of resiliency in adults. We really need to send a message out there. Moms, dads, you need to take care of yourself, because if you don't put your oxygen mask, your kids are not going to be able to put on theirs.
Rosaura Ornego Aguayo is an assistant professor and clinical psychologist at the Medical University of South Carolina. Rosaura, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
The recent earthquakes in Puerto Rico have caused widespread power outages on the island, leaving thousands of residents without electricity. And while the power authority says it's restored electricity to around 96% of the population, intermittent outages remain. The damage is particularly severe in the southwest, where officials say it could take more than a year to repair a major power plant in the region. And PREPA, the Puerto Rican Electric Power Authority, has been in crisis for years, dealing with crumbling infrastructure, frequent power outages, and bankruptcy. And that's why some community organizations, like the Puerto Rico Community Foundation, are taking matters into their own hands. They've started installing microgrids in low-income areas after Hurricane Maria. Nelson Colon, the president of the organization, says they've already completed four projects serving 64 communities.
When the whole island was in total darkness, those four projects were powered by solar. So they didn't have one day of interruption. They didn't have any major challenges. They keep moving forward.
Under former Governor Ricardo Rosselló, Puerto Rico had made an ambitious commitment to get 100% of its energy from renewable sources like solar by 2050. But since Rosselló's resignation last summer, those plans remain uncertain. I'm joined now by Michael Dybert, an author and journalist based in San Juan, and Sergio Markswatch, a policy director for the Center for a New Economy, also in San Juan. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael, you've been reporting on the aftermath of last week's earthquake. Tell us what the infrastructure looks like in the places that you've visited so far.
I mean, it's striking, really. I mean, particularly in Guanica, which was, I would say, the community most severely hit on the south. And ironically, also where the U.S. Military first landed in 1898 when they invaded Puerto Rico, you have pretty widespread destruction and, I would say, depopulation as well. You know, there's quite a bit of collapsed buildings and very few people still actually living in the center of the city. A lot of people have moved elsewhere or living in, you know, makeshift or temporary accommodations.
What is the power situation like in that region, in the southwest part of the island?
I think it's come back in some places, but so many people are living in such kind of improvised accommodations. I mean, I don't think a lot of people have regular access to the fruits of electricity as they're used to having when they're living in their own homes. And of course, PREPA service can be somewhat spotty in normal times, so to speak. So that's been something that's been an ongoing problem even before the earthquake.
Michael, you mentioned PREPA, which is the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority. There have been calls for the executive director, Jose Ortiz, to resign. There's been a hashtag, Jose Ortiz Renuncia. Tell us about that. Where does that stand?
I mean, I think people are pretty upset with his performance. In an interview, he said that, you know, he was called to lead PREPA and he didn't send a CV into anyone, which I think gave a not really great impression to people about his attitude towards the crisis.
Sergio, where does FEMA stand? I mean, we know they've had a spotty record with the island so far since Hurricane Maria. Are they able to repair the grid?
Congress actually appropriated $2 billion just after Hurricane Maria in 2017, and they were earmarked specifically to modernize the grid. That money, unfortunately, has not been disbursed yet by the federal government. I don't know if it's FEMA's fault, if it's the Office of Management and Budget, but something definitely is holding up the money in Washington, D.C.
Sergio, last May, we said Puerto Rico announced a very ambitious plan. This is under Governor Ricardo Rosselló, who since stepped down after protests mounted on the island. He set out an ambitious plan to get all of the island's electricity from renewables by 2050. What progress has the island made since then?
Unfortunately, very little. Approximately around 5% of all the electricity produced in Puerto Rico right now comes from renewable sources. It's going to be very difficult to reach that target at this pace. We need PREPA and the private sector to start investing a lot more aggressively in these renewable sources. Otherwise, we're just probably going to miss the deadline.
And not just the deadline. I mean, Sergio, do you think that this is ultimately a solution for these infrastructure issues, given that there have been natural disasters like Hurricane Maria, like the earthquakes going forward?
Well, it would certainly help. As we listened to Dr. Colon, he did mention that, you know, those communities that had access to mini-grids that were connected to solar panels did not suffer an outage. And that's the whole point. I mean, we're trying to change the system from a centralized system where you have five or six big units around the island to a lot of smaller generation capacity located in many points across the island. So when we have an earthquake, say in Guanica, which is in the southwest part of the island, the East Coast, for example, doesn't have to suffer a complete outage.
We mentioned that since Rosselló has stepped down, there's been a lot of change in Puerto Rico, not just at natural disasters, but also politically. Wanda Vasquez is the new governor of the island, and she's got a new administration. Is there political will, Sergio, to continue to push for solar at that level?
That's going to be an interesting question. Mrs. Vasquez is from the same party as Governor Rosselló. So in theory, she would not have any political constraints in terms of pushing forward. However, she hasn't been very clear as to what her plan is going forward. And of course, we have elections in November, so that could change everything.
Michael, when you talk to residents of the island who've been affected by this most recent wave of earthquakes, are people talking about solar energy directly? Are they talking about what Wanda Vasquez is saying or not saying, or are their concerns much more basic than that?
I think one thing is that people feel like they've been extremely battered in recent years by these natural disasters, and it's really, you know, kind of rocking them back on their heels yet again. And I think, you know, one thing that a lot of folks on the ground hear is they're just wondering, I think they wish perhaps that the state as a whole could be a little bit more responsive to their needs. I think a lot of people maybe feel that, the political parties in San Juan, and it's an interesting figure that I always remember, is that like 70% of the energy in Puerto Rico, I think it is created in the south of the country, and the usage is 70% in the north. So it's kind of this reverse relationship that places have. And I think a lot of these people who don't necessarily feel like the political actors in San Juan, in the capital, are really necessarily advocating for their interests all of the time.
Sergio, we've seen to that point that some communities have decided to take the situation into their own hands and built their own solar power networks without government help. How common is it for folks to do that, and how effective is it?
It became a big part of the solution, if you will, just after Hurricane Maria, because there were communities, as you know, that were without power for almost a year after the hurricane. So there was a lot of interest, mostly from the private sector and NGOs, to try to get some independence from the government-owned electricity company. And there has been some success in terms of getting electricity mini-grids in some of the most isolated communities, but we still have a long ways to go. It's not a 100% solution right now, given that, solar power is intermittent and the grid that we have is really old. So the grid will have to be modernized in order for Puerto Rico to really scale up to the goals that were set up by Governor Rosselló. But it's a good start. And also, as I mentioned earlier, we're still waiting for a significant amount of federal money that would be used to rebuild the grid, which is an essential component of reconfiguring the whole electricity system in the island.
Sergio, Mark Swatch is the policy director for the Center for a New Economy, and Michael Dybert is an author and journalist based in San Juan. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, the furor on college campuses over the war in Gaza.
Students have tried to have dialogue over and negotiate differences in how they see the world, even as they respond to tragedies and crimes overseas.
Students and faculty from Harvard University on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. In some parts of the United States, the winter months can mean lots of bleak, cold days and freezing nights. So it's no surprise that winter is also the busiest time of year for tourism in the Caribbean. From mid-December to the beginning of April, the islands become saturated with tourists looking to escape to warm, sandy beaches and crystal blue waters. The Caribbean is one of the most tourism-dependent regions in the world, with some islands like Antigua and Barbuda relying on tourism for nearly 80% of their GDP. But very little of that money actually stays on the islands. According to the travel organization Leaf Group, up to 80% of every dollar spent by tourists goes to the global companies that own Caribbean resorts and cruises. Angelique V. Nixon is the author of Resisting Paradise, Tourism, Diaspora, and Sexuality in Caribbean Culture. And she studied issues related to the Caribbean's colonial legacy and grew up working in the Bahamas tourism industry.
It was a difficult experience, but at the same time, it was also an experience that forged who I am today. One of the things that I learned from a really young age is that how dependent we were as a country and as a people on tourists, where our bread and butter and our day-to-day living was dependent upon if tourists came to the Bahamas. So when I was working in the tourism industry as a young person, it was just a very sort of day-to-day reality.
And, Angelique, what's interesting, my family is from Puerto Rico, and the tourism industry is also huge there. And I've always found this sort of disconnect between folks that go particularly to the island of Puerto Rico, don't understand that those are also American citizens. There's almost like a two-tier system on the island. Do you find that across the Caribbean? Not so much the citizenship question, but just this two tiers of people who are native to the island and then the tourists who go there to spend money.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that was something that was very, for me as a kid growing up too, very much that
there's spaces that are for tourists and there's spaces that are for locals. And when I was in primary school, we had this program called Smile Please or Smile Bahamas, which was a tourism training program. And a lot of us in the 1980s went through it. The way that the public school system in particular, but also even the private school system kind of trains, especially from working class neighborhoods and families to go and work in the tourism industry. It's what we're trained for. There's definitely a lot of troublesome relationships, a lot of exploitation that happens because of that. And a lot of it also is about race and class, you know. And I think it was even more troublesome for Puerto Rico being literally a neo-colony of the United States.
Angelique, we know that, as you said, a lot of the islands in the Caribbean rely on tourism. But does that mean, when we say they rely on tourism, does that mean that the money stays in the island?
No, that money does not stay in the region. In fact, the reality is that much of the tourism industry is run by multinational corporations and travel tour guides and the whole business of tourism, from the hotels to the airlines to the tour companies. It ends up going to the multinational corporations, and that it also is spent, even for local companies, that we end up spending that money on importing goods for the tourism industry, right? The most terrible culprit of this, of course, are the cruise ship industry. The cruise ship industry is incredibly exploitative to the environment, to the people they employ, the very low wages they offer, and an extraordinary amount of consumption associated with the entire cruise ship industry to bring millions of people to the region. And so it looks good on paper that, you know, in the Bahamas, for example, has 3 million cruise ship passengers who come. But most of the money the tourists have already spent on their vacation, you know, and a lot of times these are folks who saved up all year, sometimes years, to go on a cruise. And the reason it's cheap, the reason you can get these package deals, right, to go to several islands across the region, is because of the fact that they keep their costs low and they keep people on the ship and they manage the entire business of the cruise ship experience, and often at the cost of the islands themselves that don't benefit largely from that, from those profits.
So let's talk a little bit about how, particularly in the Bahamas, we've seen Hurricane Dorian strike the Bahamas earlier this year, or last year, I should say. Puerto Rico just experienced a series of earthquakes that have been pretty devastating to certain parts of the island. When islands in the Caribbean are subject to natural disasters like this, what effect does that have on tourism going forward?
I mean, it's devastating, and the Bahamas is still recovering. I mean, it's a double bind of the tourism economy, right? Because we haven't invested in other industries, because it's seen as literally the model for development, often the only model for development, for economic development and prosperity. Then it creates even more challenges especially for a small economy, for the Bahamas. And, you know, immediately after Dorian, we noticed that the tourism industry, but also the government, was pushing, oh, there are other islands in the Bahamas to visit, we need your dollars, right? So don't not come. And a lot of those plans are very neoliberal. They are very focused on a model of development that does not benefit the majority of the people who live in these places, but rather a very capitalist-driven model of development, which sadly isn't going to fix some of the deep social, historical, and economic problems of these spaces.
You talk about the quote-unquote myth of paradise here, and some of that is also a reflection of the fact that people go to these islands to relax, to unwind, and they aren't aware of the history of many of these islands that includes colonialism, slavery, genocide even. Is it the responsibility of the tourism industry to teach that to tourists, or can't tourists go and spend their money as they want to in what they consider to be paradise?
The tourism industry and those who run the tourism industry are invested in a particular narrative of paradise because that's what they can sell. It's hard to sell the hardships and the stories of colonialism unless it's wrapped up in this myth of paradise and something that's very watered down. And so I think that's a part of where we need to start. And maybe it's not, we can't ask the multinational corporations to do it. In fact, I think we as Caribbean folks and who work in the business of tourism need to be the ones to also challenge that. But I think we can ask and we can expect better things. And I think it's also the onus is on us as well as to be an ethical traveler. If you're going to go to a place, you should learn about it, right? And I think we should critique those narratives that make the islands interchangeable and make it seem as if it doesn't matter, you're just going to this beautiful paradise, but actually do the work of finding out about these places and learn about the place before you go there and consume it.
Angelique V. Nixon is the author of Resisting Paradise, Tourism, Diaspora and Sexuality in Caribbean Culture. Angelique, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. But before we go, we want to take a moment to mention that Sunday marked 10 years since a 7.0 magnitude earthquake hit Haiti in 2010. An estimated 200,000 people were killed in the disaster. If you or your family were directly affected by the Haiti earthquake, tell us how you're feeling about the anniversary. You can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.